Good afternoon, everyone, again. I'm Chris Keneally for Copyright Clearance Center. And, you know, if you've been sitting through this conference about copyright and the creative industries, it can leave you with the impression that copyright has a lot of catching up to do, at least when it comes to technology. In my own mind, that seems pretty fair. After all, while there are many good reasons, and we've heard about them, for and appropriate occasions to seek permission, innovation isn't one of them. You don't ask permission to hold a revolution. A quarter century ago, a British computer scientist working in Geneva presented his boss with a proposal for a new kind of network, one able to link documents and data across the Internet. The manager had been gently encouraging this employee in his work, but he wasn't ready to commit resources. So he wrote, "vague but exciting," at the top of the memo, and Tim Berners-Lee had to work on his own. Vague but exciting. Thinking about the future will give you that kind of feeling. It's all very exciting. Google glasses, smart watches, 3D printing. And it's also a little vague. The Internet of Things. Making predictions is notoriously difficult, especially predictions about the future. So on this panel about the future is already here, we won't ask for predictions per se, because we know how that would turn out. It would probably turn out like all those 11 million brackets in the ESPN Fantasy Tournament Challenge. Instead, I want to ask my guests what they are doing today, right now, not only to respond to the challenge of digital disruption and the impact it has on their creative endeavors, but also to anticipate future directions. So this is less clairvoyance and more like weather reporting. I'll introduce them for you right now. So on the very far end is Jeff Sharp. Jeff, welcome.
Hi.
Jeff is president and CEO of Story Mining and Supply Company, a Los Angeles-based production company committed to acquiring, developing, financing, and producing multi-platform premium content through unique access to quality material. Jeff Sharp has produced a series of Academy Award-winning and Golden Globe-nominated films over the past 10 years, including Boys Don't Cry, You Can Count on Me, Nicholas Nickleby, and Proof. Prior to Story Mining, Jeff co-founded the digital publisher Open Road Integrated Media with former HarperCollins CEO Jane Friedman. And beside Jeff is Tomoko Hosaka. Tomoko, welcome. Tomoko is a journalist turned digital media entrepreneur. As COO of Plimpton, she oversees business operations and strategy there, as well as management of their online product, Daily Lit. She's previously worked at Ustream, the world's largest live interactive video platform, where she led news content strategy and partnerships. It's critical to say that before moving to Silicon Valley in late 2011, Tomoko Hosaka covered Japan as a business and technology writer for Associated Press. She was part of a team that won awards for its coverage of the 2011 earthquake, tsunami, and nuclear disaster. And then finally, to my left is Patrick Sullivan. Patrick, welcome. Patrick is an innovative technology entrepreneur and investor who is CEO and co-founder of Rightsflow, a music licensing and royalty management company, which Google acquired in 2011. As strategic partner development manager at Google today, he spearheads key content licensing, monetization, and copyright identification initiatives. So with all of that, I thought I'd start with Jeff, because this is a quote from William Gibson, which is, "The future is already here. It's just not evenly distributed." Mm-hmm. And you've just returned from Hong Kong. You were there for the Hong Kong Festival. And what's interesting about the China example is that it's the largest smartphone market in the world, but it's also a place where they're building movie screens still. There's something like 10 a day on average, more than anywhere else, any other country. And so what we're seeing there is, you know, really sort of very new technology and, if you will, legacy technology. It's interesting, I think, as a way to get you to tell us about your experiences in that marketplace.
Sure, absolutely. Well, China is a real area of fascination, I think, for many of us. For us as filmmakers and publishers, you know, the market offers up all sorts of opportunities to innovate, to look to new ways of collaboration, new forms of collaboration. I've always looked to publishing relationships to supply the content strategy for the films and TV shows that we produce in China, based on the IP. Situation, publishers control the rights in partnership with their authors. So it makes partnerships with traditional publishers and online publishers quite easy to form. So we've made partnerships with some of the leading publishers in China, including Shanda Cloudery. Shanda Cloudery is the largest online publisher, and the reason I use them as an example is, you know, you mentioned all the screens, proliferation of screens and mobile devices in China. So, you know, mobile reading is extremely popular in China right now. So we source a lot of our movie ideas from these online novels, which are basically serialization. You know, they go on for hundreds and hundreds of pages. The authors are paid by chapter to continue writing these, you know, these stories that their audiences are addicted to. So we're taking that kind of like, content pool and adapting that for films, which are designed to be released theatrically. So you're taking this kind of very, very new, innovative, you know, publishing kind of, you know, technology and adapting it for a very traditional, format, which is really interesting. So a lot of different things are happening at the same time.
Yeah, you kind of have to hold a number of different ideas in your mind at the same time. I was looking online to see what some of the top grossing films in China were last year. And so Iron Man earned $124 million, Gravity at $71 million. But one of these films I think you're speaking about, Tiny Times, a tale of four wealthy Chinese girls, and it's apparently just captivated the country.
Yeah, the last few years have seen domestic production, domestic films overtake U.S. imports dramatically. In fact, this last year, you know, the box office was led by Chinese domestically produced films based on underlying Chinese Mandarin, you know, language content.
Right. But the model that you have at Story Mining and Supply is to, as you say, work with the local players, particularly identifying authors who you can then partner with screenwriting talent in the U.S. Tell us how that'll work.
Yeah, it's a little bit, in process, but the way we've designed this partnership is we're taking, you know, Chinese IP, so, you know, Mandarin language content, a lot of it online, a lot of it traditional, partnering with Chinese filmmakers, and then using a U.S. screenwriter to help ensure sort of a quality, you know, basic three-act structure, a lot of things that are lacking from, you know, the market at the moment. It's primarily due to the fact that there's just such demand for content. There's not enough talent to go around. So we're leveraging our Hollywood screenwriting talent to ensure that these films are of a quality that might actually work on an international stage.
Right, and the other thing that's interesting is, again, another format that's a very traditional one is the book. And you've written that the book is a great conveyor of ideas. It's a way to present something to a film director, for example, and say, what do you think of this? So the book still has a great value as well.
The book has great value, whether it's online, digital, or it's a physical book, not only for filmmakers, producers alike, but also for financiers. When we're going out and, raising funds for our China strategy, it's great to have some tangible kind of the foundation for a story sitting right there. Investors get very excited about that. In fact, distributors in that market are willing to sign on and guarantee distribution for a film based on a book before there's even a screenplay.
Remarkable. Well, Tomoko Hosaka, at Plimpton, just last month at the South by Southwest conference, you launched a new reading app that kind of takes the book into the future. Tell us about that.
We hope it takes the book into the future. So you talked about serialization. I think we, that's part of our strategy. And the previous speaker, talked a lot about listening to your customer. And I think that's what we really tried to do as we were developing this product, and which is called Rooster. And we're calling it a curated reading service for the smartphone. And it's not an online bookstore. We would really very much want it to be a service. And one of the things we kept hearing over and over in our market research as we were developing was that there were a big population of people who say they want to read more, but they just don't have the time.
That's me. I wish I had more time.
Right. And so we really thought about this a lot and thought about what kind of product we could create to address this population.
And can I just say, the people who are doing the thinking about this are writers themselves.
Yeah.
And not only are you a journalist by background, but some of the others on the team come from journalism, there's a novelist and so forth.
Right, so our CEO, Jennifer Aitley, she's a former New York Times reporter, and she wrote a best-selling book on Chinese food. And our other co-founder, Yael Goldstein-Love, is a novelist herself, and she comes from a family of writers as well. So
these are people with real passion.
Yeah, absolutely,
writing.
Absolutely. And so what we ended up creating was a mobile-first reading service where one of the things we discovered was that the choice was actually a barrier to people reading more, and that they were overwhelmed with the hundreds and thousands of book titles coming out every year. And so we kind of went the opposite way and said, well, why don't we kind of really eliminate that choice and present people a very highly curated selection of titles every month and say, this, if you're going to be reading, this is what you should be reading this month. And then each title we have is broken up into installments. So suddenly length isn't a barrier either, because reading a 400-page novel may be very intimidating and hard to start, but if that's broken up into smaller installments, which are delivered to you on your own schedule that you decide. So if you want it Monday, Wednesday, Friday in the morning, you can do that. If you want it every day in the evening, you can do that as well, or every weekend. So that's kind of the product that we end up creating.
So again, it really is about the importance of the customer in that relationship.
Absolutely.
You have.
Yeah, yeah.
But you also have relationships with the authors mm-hmm. and the agents, too.
Yeah.
Tell us about that, because how do they respond to this new way of thinking about publishing?
Yeah, so the way we acquire content is we do a combination of we commission our own fiction, so our own original kind of exclusive works, as well as we're starting to work more and more with publishers as well who are interested in our platform. And, you know, we really tapped in our initial, because we're a startup, in our initial round, we really tapped authors who, you know, had a track record of really high quality writing and success, and really tried to find the ones who were excited about changes and new platforms and were willing to work with us on that. And with publishers are a little bit trickier to work with, because some of them have, you know, very established rules in place and things that they're constraints and things that they're able to do and not able to do. So,
And you've learned some things the hard way too, right? I think that you had some contracts that were on the subscription side of things and now on the serialization side. This is
right.
My kind of going back. And
right. I mean, there are certainly we're a monthly subscription service. So for $4.99, you pay, it's like a monthly fee, and you get selections that we bring to you. And so for some publishers, working with us is a challenge because they're allergic to subscriptions for various reasons. So that's been a challenge. But there are enough publishers out there who are interested and recognize the need to engage kind of new services and companies.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, Patrick Sullivan, your job at Google is listening to a lot of great ideas, some of the ideas you've just heard and many that we've spoken about today, and sifting through them. What attracts your attention these days when you hear these presentations?
You know, a company like Google is so big and it has a lot of innovation going on and development internally. But for me personally, what I've seen in particular in the New York area, and I think it's important, I think talking about the earlier discussion about technology innovations, how it impacts the publishing industry, copyright industry, is really getting out there, you know, talking to your customers more importantly, but seeing the trends and the future business models that will exist. And I spend a lot of my time with incubators, startups, accelerator, organizations like General Assembly, Techstars. These are the evolution of the new businesses that could be the next publishing platform, media platform that could be acquired by Google, or it could be a public company and be the next Facebook. And I think that from my perspective, you know, looking at that and seeing how that's going to impact, you know, whether it's the movie industry, the book industry, I think it's important you start to do that, your people do that. And I came from the traditional music publishing industry, and it was kind of a hesitancy and resistance, I think, 10 years ago to technology development, because it was moving faster on a supply and demand levels and economic levels they'd never seen. The supply was controlled. It was radio, Tower Records, and it was controlled by major record companies, how that content was accessible. And along came, you know, businesses that technology innovated, like iTunes and YouTube. So I think that, you know, if I were in the position of where you are, I'd have a perspective on where that trend is going to happen from those young innovators that are building these companies, these startups, and are thinking how to solve problems with technology solutions that can impact your business, and be aware and be maybe one of the acquirers that can change your business for the next 10 to 15 years, and not be in a defensive position on an island thinking the business will sustain and the model of they will come will continue, think the distributed way, and that, you know, those businesses will think how they can distribute your content in ways you've never seen.
Right.
And they're thinking about it right now.
Right. The example of Napster has come up a couple of times in the course of the day's discussion, and you feel that it has some lessons to teach us today, particularly regarding 3D printing, which we'll see a demonstration of later.
Yeah,
tell us about
that. Over my interest, I don't know if you're familiar with 3D printing. Imagine the world where we lived in before. We could photocopy books and print it out at home or in the library, all the copyrighted material is printable and accessible to anyone, and you didn't have to pay copyright owners in some instances. But the world of 3D printing enables anyone who's created a design on a digital design, on a CAD file, computer animated design file, the ability to create a design and then print an object. The software on the scanning side and the hardware is still kind of its infancy. It's been around 30 years. But think of the mainframe computers, IBM, the photocopiers that we used to have years ago that were massive. But that ability exists today, and MakerBot here is presenting has a technology and a hardware that allows you to print out, you know, works that they license, not MakerBot, but their consumers license IP around printing copyright or printing objects and creating new objects, derivatives, user-generated content. And it's a disruption. It's something that, you know, from my perspective, I see it's inevitable. It's here, and it is the future. How advanced it gets in the next 3 to 5 to 7 years, contingent on technology development.
Right. Well, so the point, though, is that, you know, in the case of Napster, the industry tried to step on Napster. And I guess what I hear you saying is embrace the 3D printing because it's here.
Yeah, I think, you know, coming from the world of licensing in my background, it's a challenge because, you know, in the Napster world, I was part of the Napster litigation team against Napster. It was a very defensive because I think we weren't set up at the time for scaled licensing systems. The ability to take music, put it into a platform like a Napster system, open Pandora's box for access. I think we're all familiar with that. The same thing is going to happen in 3D printing. There's going to be a new world, a revolution, evolution of manufacturing. And, you know, for people that own designs and IP with the scanning technologies and the print technologies, it's going to be very resonant. You know, the difference of industry on scale is much larger. We're talking about $70 trillion industry in manufacturing, you know, compared to the industry I was in at the time recording music, around $40 billion. There's a lot of change disruption, but I would say in the IP world, start to embrace back to the earlier discussion I said of the technologies like MakerBot that exist today and see how you're going to fit your business into the future. Talk to your customers. Your customers might want their copyrighted materials printed at home rather than going into Amazon or going to Amazon online or going to Home Depot. And in the case of Napster, we weren't ready as an industry, as an IP industry, to embrace that. The challenge you have is technology is here. And we're still trying to catch up at times. But in that, where we are still in the early gate, I think with 3D printing, we have a chance as IP owners to look at where we'll end up in 3 to 5 years with our rights and licensing.
Right. And Jeff, Open Road, really, it jumped on an opportunity fairly early in the cycle with ebooks. And you put ebooks as a publisher at the center of what you did. That was really important. But around that, you did all sorts of other really creative things.
That's right. Over the course of the last few years, we've experimented wildly with developing enhanced ebooks, developing for television and film. Some of those things are coming to fruition. Some of those experiments were just that, experiments. We're still really open to those kind of opportunities to pull together as a team and look at something with a slightly different focus.
And it seems to me it's not a sort of either or, it's an and. So we put ebooks at the center and we have the film projects and the TV projects and so forth.
That's right. We have a big in-house production department. You know, we create a lot of original video content for authors to promote, primarily for marketing purposes, but it lives out there in the world, you know, in a larger,
right.
larger
and,
sense.
And it's unusual to see the words startup and publisher side by side. We'll talk to Tomoko about her experience in that situation, but for Open Road early on, it kind of made you an outlier, I think. It must have been an interesting experience in those early days.
Well, you know, I'm a film producer by background, so to find myself, you know, in the role of a publisher, a startup publishing, you know, outfit was really surprising. It wasn't what I expected at all. You know, I ended up backing into it. My obsession with finding the story first and getting to the content first led me to my business partner, Jane Friedman, when she was CEO of HarperCollins, which is how I ended up moving into the business. That's my journey. But Open Road has always been a little bit, you know, untraditional,
right.
Non-traditional.
Well, and it's untraditional for a journalist to be working at a startup as well, although there are more and more and more of them. They call it the digital migration. There was a report recently from Pew documented just how many hundreds have moved into the startup space. And they face the challenges that you face there. So you move from a really sort of established organization to where you can work almost independently as a journalist to being part of a small team where you have to do everything.
Right, right. Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting transition. You know, when you're a journalist, You're essentially, your job is basically content that you produce yourself. I mean, that's your entire focus, right? Whether it's a story or video or whatnot. And when you move into a startup, whether it's a digital media startup, or I mean, you're forced to do everything. So everything from worrying about the content to product, to business development, to HR, to all sorts of things. So yeah, it's a very interesting transition. But more and more journalists, I think, are becoming very passionate about the changes happening in their own industry and in digital media, and are compelled to kind of break free. And I do think there are a lot of opportunities for journalists, not just the startups, but there, you know, more and more companies and organizations are getting into the content business of content, and so there are, you know, opportunities.
Right, I was going to say there are great opportunities because these journalists have these storytelling skills.
Yeah,
Jeff is looking for good stories.
Right.
Journalists know how to tell a good story.
Right, exactly.
And in fact, some of the projects you're acquiring are based on nonfiction, so it's not entirely fictional
work. That's right.
It's important.
Absolutely.
Patrick Sullivan, for someone contemplating the startup life here as either a mindset, and I know it at Brian Kibbe's outfit, that's what they try to think of themselves as. They don't want to think of themselves as a publisher. They're in the learning solutions business. Can you offer some advice? What's a good way to approach it when you get in there for the day?
You know, if you're an established company or you're a startup, you know, the core things you got to look at, whether it's a new business that you're trying to develop around your current customer base or grow your business, you know, I'm always in particular trying to solve problems, you know, whether, you know, it's internally where I work today, or trying to identify new problems that will be tomorrow or exist today as well. And, you know, and then coming up with some sort of solution around that, and hopefully there's an economic model around that and some addressable market. But I think, you know, when you're starting your business, the main thing you got to have is some sort of problem you're going to solve your startup. You know, you just can't say I'm starting a company and I'm going to do something, you know, similar to Facebook, which has solved a lot of problems for a lot of people that are addicted to social media and compete with that. But I think, you know, that's the main advice. But, you know, execution is key, you know, and without people and process and technology are around that, you can't execute your business. And you know, I spent a lot of time publicly speaking out there in the startup community, investment banking community. And you know, these little things, you know, you may know or aware of about execution, but really understanding the fundamentals of that and, you know, bottom-up management and looking at, you know, your team and how they succeed. And I think management leadership has changed since I, you know, started my career 20 years ago. And with the tools that are available online, social media, awareness, information sources, that, you know, you got to be able to give that and empower people that so they can succeed.
Right. And so this problem-solution situation is, the solution has to be a certain type of solution, though. I think you look at it as either a vitamin or a painkiller.
I think it's a very hard thing for people to see, you know, because, and it was a good lesson that I learned, very, you know, important, was, you know, is your business a painkiller? You know, I'll use YouTube, Facebook, Google, the companies I'm aware of. Those are pain. People need, they're addicted. They need it to run their business. So Facebook, you can say, is a vitamin, but there's a billion people using it. So it's solving a pain for a lot of people. They want to connect with their friends and families and colleagues that they can't get to. Or your vitamin, it's like, I don't really need it today. And I think it's a challenge for some companies. I think in the licensing space, because people can get away with unlicensed content, and that's a challenge. And you have to create and empower, create ways innovative around that to help empower people to get access to content so they can, you know, A, get access to it and license it, or license and get access. But that very important lesson, painkiller, vitamin. And I talk to a lot of people, I'm like, that's really not solving a lot of problems for anyone because they don't really need it. And, you know, there's a way to, you know, if it's something you use twice a day, it's usually a painkiller that you need to do and you need to use.
Well, certainly people go to films a great deal. They're watching movies on their tablets, on their smartphones, and so forth. And I wonder whether they're beginning to think about becoming involved in the process themselves. I was reading that Alibaba, which is the giant e-commerce site in China, kind of the Amazon of China and much more, has just started an online fundraising for a couple of its film projects. And I wonder whether you've, in your travels in China, Jeff, have seen you know, a movement toward bringing the audience into the development of these projects?
Yeah, I think we've seen a lot of conversation around it. I mean, Amazon certainly,
right,
you know, Roy's been doing some interesting stuff as well with, you know, kind of audience you know, generated either with their TV pilots or with their feature program. They had Amazon Studios. Roy Price was developing this idea. I think it's really fascinating. It's cool. I haven't, you know, it's early days. We haven't really seen, you know, a lot come from that kind of, you know, that kind of activity. But, you know, with the online novels that we're using, you know, those are audience-driven kind of stories. So in some sense, you know, the films that we're making for that market are inspired by the audience. And while it's not user-generated content, you know, it's somehow, you know, it's inspired by, you know, the kind of things that they want to see. So, you know, too soon to tell, but...
But Tomoko, what about you? Do you get input from your readers? Are you listening to what they have to say? And what are they telling you?
Yeah, I mean, it's still early, but I mean, we're definitely listening to our readers, and both in terms of the technology and the content and the feedback. I mean, our launch title is a serial novel called I Was Here by Rachel Kadish, and that's gotten incredible feedback. People are very excited about it, and excited about the format as well, the serial format, because I think for most people who try our service, they've actually never experienced a serial novel.
Well, it sounds like you're solving a pain problem for them. They want to read, and they feel like they're missing something in their lives.
That's our hypothesis.
How's that as a hypothesis? Do you think people is in the publishing world, do people lack for content at all?
I definitely don't think it's a lack of content. I think, you know, it's a challenge with filtering content you want to read and watch. I personally believe everyone needs to read. You know, you can't exist. You can't, or to some maybe not. You can be a vitamin approach to watching movies and TV. Some people I know don't have TVs And I understand how they, you know, live, but I need to watch TV. I enjoy, and I think to me that's a need. You know, the challenge then becomes what's the choices on the shelves of what you watch. And you know, I think that as more and more content is accessible, it becomes a challenge to how to filter and curate. And I think even the businesses that we're seeing online and the Pandoras, these music companies, they still need to have a filtering system. That's just not a technology solution. It's people curating content. You know, obviously there's a technology component to it, but I think that, you know, it takes great companies that can produce great content that meets the needs of their user base, and it solves that pain for them that want it and want to access it and need to access it, more importantly. And so I think it's we're not lacking content. You know, I think everyone's a creator. You know, that's why I'm interested in the 3D printing space, where, you know, I'm looking at it from the next generation of children growing up in America. And the White House has initiatives, and we've done a lot of talks with them on how they're developing this maker approach, where, you know, if you think of the computer, the personal computer in the home, imagine a world that can post personal computer, which a lot of people have in their homes in the United States, will then have a printer associated with that, another piece of hardware that enables them to create. And it could create a whole new world of manufacturing, and then you need to manufacture and print, just like people need to manufacture articles, movies, books that they can do today on YouTube. Anyone's a creator, a video creator. We can create a little movie right now about this, or a little documentary, and we're all creators. It's real. Will everyone make money? Maybe not, maybe some. But I think the idea of creation and that idea of where it becomes the new world of manufacturing hardware, which excites me a lot.
Absolutely, and it's a global endeavor. And so, Jeff, again, I go back to you, going back and forth a bit, jet lag from Hong Kong, and ask you finally how difficult it is to find stories that have universal appeal.
You know, at this point, we're really looking for material that speaks directly, specifically to a market, and not trying to tick all the boxes at once. Where our belief is that quality travels everywhere. So, you know, there's an amazing group of emerging filmmakers in the market at this point in China, as there are in the U.S., and, you know, great quality content travels well. So, you know, we're really focusing on the domestic market for the projects. For instance, we're producing a television series right now called Outlander, which is based on Diana Gabaldon's series for Starz and Sony. We just got greenlit for our second season. We premiere here in June. And, you know, that's something that is Scotland's 1740s, right? Very specific, no Starz. You know, we're all casting locally. You know, it's a primarily UK production. But we have great hopes and expectations it's going to travel internationally, as Diana's books have. So I think it's an example of, you know, you cultivate and develop stories, you know, for a very specific world and market, and then hope that, you know, if you really work very hard on the quality and packaging the best talent available, that you can find a larger market.
Does that resonate with you, Tomoko, as well? You sort of focus right now on the North American marketplace
and
think about the world later.
Yeah. I mean, we definitely want to expand globally, but I think right now we want to make sure that we get North America right.
And again, I think getting something right first, having a little bit of success under your belt seems really important for a startup or for any early project.
Right.
Yeah, great. Patrick Sullivan, Tomoko Hosaka, Jeff Sharp, thank you so much for a great conversation.
Thank you.